Next item, agenda item two, another informational item, carbon sequestration in Oregon's forests. And we'll have Andrew Yost and Angus Duncan. Looks like just Angus Duncan.
What?
Well, Andrew, is here. Oh,
okay.
Thank you. So I'm not all alone.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I actually want to thank you for having the meeting in the Grand. It's a long way from Portland, admittedly. But during my service on the Northwest Power Council, which was mostly the Northwest Fish Council at the time, I ended up getting to spend, minimal time in Portland, a lot of time, at both ends of the Columbia River, and particularly up in Union and Wallowa counties, working on watershed restoration with the local watershed councils up here. And I came away from that experience both, totally admiring the amount of work and the sensible approach that those watershed councils were taking to restoration up here, but also with a great yearning to get back up into the mountains every chance I got when I got here. And so I have a campground, way up the Lostine, that I can drive to, and did on Monday night, and spent the night up there, and got a little time on the trails before I came into the meeting, and it's wonderfully restorative, so I appreciate it. So I have a couple of opening observations here. The first one is that this issue was vastly more complicated than, we thought it would be when the Global Warming Commission decided that it had to go back and take another look at forest carbon. I say, and I'm not far off, I think, that there's more complexity in an acre of forest up here than there is in the entire Western electrical grid. And I understand the grid a lot better than I understand that acre of forest. And so I approach this with, a degree of modesty and concern that we don't overstate the findings that we have been able to put together so far in the process of handing this task off to the Oregon Department of Forestry for refinement before it goes to legislative action on carbon limitations. The second one is that I went into this with a number of expectations, and the most significant of those just got upended in the process. So it was a humbling experience to sit down and look at the data and say, that's not what I expected. That said, we did take a first look at forest carbon back in 2010 and 2011 when we put together, what we called the roadmap to 2020 for the legislature. We had a half a dozen advisory committees that we put together, including one on forestry, with the Department of Forestry, Forest Service, BLM, environmental groups, wood products representatives. And we came out of it saying, we don't know what to say about forests other than the general recommendation that we should be leading, that West Side forests are accruing carbon. And until we understand that process better, we should just leave them alone to accrue carbon. That East Side forests looked as though they needed a lot of active restoration attention before carbon became a significant player in those East Side forests, and that for the time being, product needed to come from private holdings. And that's about as complex as we could get, other than to say we need more and better data. We did not include forest carbon in either of the state's carbon inventory, so those inventory numbers you see do not include any forest carbon, plus or minus. And And we specifically acknowledge that forests are different from power plants. They're different from cars. In those cases, you know, our objective is to reduce emissions from those sources. But forests can either be a source or a sink. And so they really needed to be treated differently, and they needed to have, we needed to have a better understanding of what goes on in that acre of forest before we could even come to preliminary recommendations. That said, in the intervening 6 or 8 years, the Forest Service responded to us, and I'm sure to other requests, you know, with by developing their FIA data, which now give us carbon content and carbon activity by a number of different breakdowns, by ecoregion, by ownership, and by carbon pool within the forests themselves. The FIA breakdowns of five pools in the forest, you know, are arbitrary but very helpful. The School of Forestry at OSU uses slightly different ecoregions and slightly different pools of carbon within the forest. And to those in-forest pools, we have added, because we think we needed to, a wood products pool to deal with carbon that's taken out of the forest, that is processed into different wood products and goes through its own, in effect, carbon evolution, so that we can understand how carbon flows, you know, from pool to pool within the forest, from the forest into that wood products pool, from that wood products pool back to the atmosphere. You know, all this stuff is moving all the time. Not going to go through this in detail, but I would just observe that some 60% of the acres of forest in Oregon are federal. About 36% are private. And that also feeds into some of the key takeaways. The first one, and possibly the most important one, is there's a lot of carbon out in those forests. There's something in the order of 3 billion tons of carbon, or about 11 billion tons of CO2 equivalent. And I should just digress here and say, wherever we're able to, we're trying to convert these numbers from teragrams, from metric tons, from carbon, to something that we can use that is comparable to the other ways that we measure carbon in Oregon. So we're trying to convert these to carbon dioxide equivalent short tons, and to the extent we're able to, that's how we will try to express these from now on. With 60% of the acres of forest, federal forests are storing about 73% of the forest carbon. And private forests are approximately the reverse. There is movement of carbon from the atmosphere into the forest. It's a little imprecise still. We think we are acquiring somewhere between 23 and 63 million tons of CO2 annually. That is to say, our forests are a net sink. We are adding carbon in significant quantities. It may be useful just to do a quick comparison. We store about 3 billion tons of carbon in our forests. California stores about 2 billion on roughly the same acreage of forest land. So we have much more carbon intensive forests. And those are primarily on the west side. They are the west side of the Cascades, the Coast Range, the Klamath ecoregion, where most of that carbon is being acquired on a net basis. And that's logical and intuitive. You know, the wet side of Oregon is going to have denser forests and more carbon. And if you look at the amount of carbon in forests, starting roughly with the redwoods in Northern California and running all the way up to Alaska, you know, this is a significant amount of forest carbon, significant on a global basis. And I want to come back to that toward the end of this. So I'm going to go through some key takeaways here as well. Nationally, forest carbon increased by about 10%. since 1990. Most of that's, a lot of that's going to be in the West. I don't have the breakdown, but clearly Oregon forests and those west side federal forests, from Northern California up to Alaska are an extremely significant part of that overall acquisition. The U.S. National Climate Assessment, identified the well-watered forests of the Pacific Coast, you know, as significant to national goals and global goals for acquiring and sequestering carbon. That is in contrast to overall global numbers where deforestation continues and has contributed a huge amount to the atmospheric buildup of carbon globally. FIA, as I said, noticed five different pools, but the largest amounts of carbon in those pools are either in live trees or in soil carbon. Soil carbon doesn't move around a lot. It's relatively stable, but live trees do move around a lot. And so they are both acquiring carbon and losing carbon into the other pools and into the forest products pool. That's why we added a forest products pool of harvested material, lumber, paper, and so on. And we have tried at least initially to understand where the carbon is retained and where the carbon is lost, you know, when a tree is taken down in the forest. The numbers are still moving around a bit, but generally, I think our conclusion is, well, we'll get to those. So let's actually move on to those. So we need better measurement. We need better analysis methodologies between the work that ODF is contemplating and a lot of the work that's been done in California as well that we ought to be able to latch onto and make use of. We think in the next, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, we will have better data to support better policy. But we know that we have substantial opportunities to increase the amount of forest carbon stores. That will be a function of forest choice, forest practice choices. It will vary by ecoregion and by ownership. But again, it's like robbing banks because that's where the money is. You know, we will go principally to those west side forests because that's where the carbon is and that's where the opportunity to increase amounts of carbon, can probably be found. Forest wildfire. This is one of those assumptions going in of mine that really got upended. We know that more acres of fire are more acres of forest are burning now than they burned in an earlier period. This, by the way, is a chart from Yost et al.
No.
Yeah, I think so.
Davis et al.
Well, whatever. Davis, someone in Yost. Okay. Just acknowledgement where acknowledgement is necessary. So more acres, we know that at least some of this has to do with forest management or fire management practices, but some of it is also driven by climate change. The Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State, you know, is documenting the number of acres of fire that we would expect without and with the effects of climate change over the last several decades. That said, it is not at all clear that we are losing significant amounts of carbon to the atmosphere from fire. And this is one of those assumptions that I went in with that really got upended by some of the work that's being done at Oregon State University, you know, which distinguishes between degrees of severity of forest fires and identifies most of the carbon loss occurring, you know, in areas of extremely severe forest fire, but low to moderate severity fire tends not to to release those amounts of carbon in statistically significant numbers. So that upper left chart is an acreage chart, but the lower right chart is the severity analysis, and it shows, you know, a slight but a according to the scientists, not statistically significant increase in severity, but by far the largest amounts of fire acreage are in low to moderate intensity. And if you think driving through, for example, the San Ian Pass where the Biscuit Fire effects are still evident, you see an awful lot of standing dead carbon when you drive through there. It's not live. It's moved to the dead standing wood pool, but it's still carbon and it's still stored in the forest. It will degrade over time, decompose and release carbon, but it's there for an extended period of time. And so the fire where it's low to moderate severity still leaves a substantial amount of carbon in the forest. The other one I was surprised by is what we have learned so far about the forest products, wood products pool. And that is while there is significant utilization of the wood that comes out of the forest, there's a substantial amount of wood in the form of stumps and roots and branches that is left in the forest that decomposes there, and that releases carbon back into the atmosphere when it decomposes. There is material that is residue from milling the logs, that is, you know, either burned or converted into some other usable but more rapidly decomposing, you know, product like bark dust, for example, you know, where there is release of carbon again back into the forest. When forests are thin for forest health, basically any time you take a piece of wood out of the forest, you reduce the amount of carbon in that forest. Now, that's not a hard jump to make. The question is it a significant amount? And the ancillary question is, how long does it take to restore that carbon back into the forest once it's been taken out? This is analysis from, again, from Oregon State, which looks at zero light, medium, heavy thinning, usually for forest health reasons. And basically what it says is, the more you progress from no thinning to heavy thinning, the more you're pulling carbon out of the forest and the longer it takes to restore itself. And at least based on their categories, heavy thinning, that bottom line, does not restore itself for at least 50 years. That's significant because carbon that is released to the atmosphere today or in the next 10 to 20 years is significantly more, what do we want to say, perilous, than carbon that may be released after we have the carbon issue under control. And I presume here that we will get it under control because the alternative is not attractive. But that means that coal plants that we can shut down in the next 10 years and replace with gas or with renewables are more valuable than the same coal plants shut down, you know, from 2030 to 2040. Equally, carbon that is reserved in the forest today is and not taken out is more valuable than carbon that is reserved in the forest 10, 20, 30 years from now. The more carbon we can keep or take out of the atmosphere in the earlier years, the more we basically buy time for overall climate solutions. So the preliminary finding here is subject to the Department of Forestry revisiting it, is that whenever we take wood out of the forest, it results in net carbon losses to the atmosphere compared to leaving that wood, you know, growing in the forest. And the question is how we manage that part of the equation. The first thing we do is we improve the data still further. And it's certainly fair to say that we have pretty wide ranges on our conclusions about how much carbon is in the forest, how much carbon is being acquired, how much carbon is taking out, what the carbon effects are of what is an ever-changing wood products pool. where utilization is increasing from what it looked like, say, 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. So as we hand this project over to the Department of Forestry, you know, we do include in our report a series of recommendations for how the data can be improved so that we can get to firmer recommendations. We also want to look forward to what Oregon's forest carbon policy choices are, and I will slow down and linger a little bit on these three because, you know, they are, again, important if preliminary. The first is that we need to go back and revisit forest management practices to see how we can most effectively integrate carbon into those practices. And I think this is my single most important takeaway. We are not looking for carbon to be the driver of forest management practices. We are looking for carbon to be integrated into all of the other considerations that you as a board and foresters daily have to manage. And so those include harvest. They include the importance of that harvest to local economies, you know, like Southern Clatsop County. They include how we reintegrate fire into our forests after the years of suppressing fire, but also manage the impacts of smoke and the extending of the fire season to earlier and later months. Carbon storage and carbon acquisition have to be a part of that. And I emphasize that both carbon storage and carbon acquisition are important. If we're acquiring 30 million tons of carbon a year, but we're releasing 30 million tons of carbon a year, you know, then the acquisition is basically mooted. If we're acquiring 30 million tons and releasing 20 million tons, then we have a net sink value in our forest of 10 million tons a year. Whatever the numbers end up being, we need to understand that it is important to hold on to the carbon that is sequestered in the forest and, to the extent we can, you know, commensurate with our other values and our other needs, to acquire additional carbon in that forest. We're going to have to make some decisions about at least some of this pretty quickly because there's going to be a carbon cap bill in the legislature in early 2019. Forest carbon is going to be a part of that carbon cap, and we need to understand how we should write that legislation so that we optimize the carbon value but also recognize the other values that Oregon's forests bring to Oregon's communities and its economy. And finally, by understanding and being able to establish, you know, to quantify the amounts of carbon in our forests and entering and leaving, it raises the question of how we integrate that back into Oregon's carbon goals, which don't include forests at this point. One option is that we continue to keep forest carbon separate from what is basically energy carbon, and we stick to our energy carbon reduction goals. That's sort of that left-handed curve that is supposed to drop from 1990 levels by about 90% by 2050. If at the same time we are able to maintain or even increase the amount of carbon stored in Oregon's forests, then one possible new Oregon carbon goal that our commission will be considering is potentially aiming for the state to be carbon neutral by some time, you know, we eyeball it as sometime in the 2030s, and after that to be carbon negative, to in effect have gone from being, you know, a part of the problem globally to a part of the solution. We don't do that just because, you know, we're Oregon and we're different and, you know, we name our chicken dinners. We do it because, as I started out saying, Oregon's forests are special globally, that stretch of wet forest from Northern California to Alaska contains as much carbon acre for acre as pretty much any of the tropical forests whose carbon has been measured. It is a significant part of the global problem, and it's a significant part of the global solution, and Oregon has a piece of it. It's a global issue. We cannot think parochially when we have, you know, both this responsibility and this opportunity of how we manage, you know, our forest carbon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Can we ask questions now?
Yeah. And then we're going to hear from Andrew as well.
Okay. So I'm going to chip over here so people can hear my question.
You're welcome to move your mic and stay here too.
I guess it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Yep. And I very much appreciate this summary and agree with you on the importance of integrating carbon as we think about forest management. One thing I was just curious about is that the analysis has been the forested area only and not sort of a broader view of carbon cycles and trade-offs. and you stated, I think, several times, whenever we take wood out of the forest, we reduce carbon in the forest. That makes sense. To the extent that that wood is going into a solid wood product that is substituting for other more energy intensive products, how do we factor that into consideration? Mm-hmm. And then secondly, as the California inventory noticed, there's a significant amount of carbon lost as forest is converted to other land use. And that has always been important to me as we think about retaining the value of our working forests. And wood products has always been a key part in retaining value to working forests. So I'm just curious, how do we wrestle with those issues?
You bet. Part of the pain of going through a subject this complicated this quickly is you end up skipping over a few things, but actually, maybe I can go back to, so the last bullet there recognizes that we don't have very good information yet. We do have some information, particularly from the Oregon State folks, but we expect more information out of the California CARB analysis of forest carbon, particularly on issues of product substitution, of leakage, and of conversion, all three of the issues that you raise. Conversion, at least as nearly as we can tell, relying heavily on ODF analysis, you know, is not a significant issue in Oregon. And I think that, and that's, I think, attributable largely to our land use, laws. Compare us to Washington, to California. You know, we look pretty good on the conversion, calendar. But it is possible, and we would raise the option of going to a, you know, zero net conversion rule in the state of Oregon, and at least look at the potential carbon benefits of that. Substitution and leakage issues are have been looked at, as I say, and they look, you know, I'm not even going to presume to go there. They are the two areas where I think I am least confident of, you know, the numbers that we have seen so far. So.
And I would just like to make a clarifying point. That 34% of quote loss to the forest isn't really loss. All of the forests by all types of ownership have more carbon today than they have 10 years ago. So what you're saying is potentially, there could have been more left on the stump, but there hasn't been any net emissions. In fact, we're storing 30 million metric tons per year in our forest, and all of our forests are increasing in carbon by ownership as well. So any addition to the long-lived wood products pool is actually additional storage of CO2.
That's exactly right. And again, in an earlier slide that I elided over in the interest of time, but I'm glad you brought it up. So about 80% of the new carbon that we are acquiring in Oregon forests is coming on federal lands. Well, that's not unreasonable. You know, that's most of the forest land in Oregon. About 16% is coming onto private woodlots, you know, which are not managed as intensively as industrial forests. But even industrial forests are acquiring, in the last 10 to 15 years, have been acquiring, you know, approximately, a net of approximately 4% additional carbon per year. So all of our forest lands are acquiring, and the question we raise is whether there are changes in forest management practices that could increase that amount of forest carbon, and if there are, what are the trade-offs if we do that?
And I would pose that the correct question is, what's the best forest management strategy to affect the overall climate mitigation? And there are some studies that, one in Sweden and one in Canada, that suggest it's not, simply storing in forests is not the most effective once you take into effect leakage, substitution effects. And I think there's going to be a real difference when we look at the short term versus long term, because it does take a while to accumulate in forests. And so we haven't done that analysis yet. And so I think there's some real analysis that needs to be completed before we can reach conclusions around that.
Yes, that's why when I referenced the one piece of information we had, you know, one piece of information is not enough. It, you know, we really need to look at these leakage and substitution issues, you know, in detail, you know, and I agree entirely, you know, with Peter that, that there are conflicting pieces of evidence out there that warrant us going in and looking at this a lot more intensely. I also would underscore that short-term, long-term set of issues. As I said earlier, if we can close a coal plant in the 2020s, it's better than closing the same plant in the 2030s or the 2040s. If we can increase carbon retention in our forests in the 2020s, that's more important in exactly the same way than doing it in the 30s or the 40s, or decreasing carbon today and restoring it 50 years from now. So those long-term, short-term trade-offs are important as well.
I think I just have to offer a comment. I agree that this has to be considered. I think it's interesting that, as you stated, as the data states, the Oregon forest lands are contributing, even on private, 4%. Yet, I think this needs to be looked at beyond forest land. I mean, taking the simplistic form of anytime you cut a tree, you're taking carbon out, which I understand that you, well, then we ought to convert farmland to forest land so that we just become a carbon sink. But that's where you start getting into, hey, these are serious trade-offs that we're talking about. When we start embarking on how to contemplate carbon relative to forest management policy and those types of things, not that we don't try to grapple with this, but I think we have to be very careful about always focusing just on the forest. We do have to grapple with these. So if it's not a two before, if it's not a CLT panel, then what is it? This isn't going to be an easy solution. Mm-hmm. We thought state forests were challenging. this will be very challenging.
Believe me. And I would just like to say that reforestation and afforestation are two of the strategies that are on the table to look at. I personally think we ought to be looking seriously at the first one, but I have severe doubts about the second one. I mean, there are reasons trees didn't grow on that grassland before. Do we really think that it's going to grow now, particularly given, you know, changes in climate that are on balance probably adverse to forests and that will drive Oregon's topography probably to be looking more like California's, you know, over the next, you know, 40 to 50 years based on what the Climate Change Research Institute is able to describe to us going forward. So, you know, afforestation sounds like a real reach to me. We should look at it. But there certainly are areas, particularly in the Willamette Valley, where forests were cleared in order to plant crops. And we may want to go back and take a look at those and look at both the biology and the economics of conversion back to forest. Doesn't mean we have to do it. Does mean we should look at it.
Although on a humorous note, I drive I-5 a lot, and they're converting it to filbert forest. A fair amount of it.
Right, and political signs. Right. A lot of forest product is locked up in political signs along I-5 corridor.
I appreciate this whole conversation, and I don't know whether this is me just sort of harping on my own private concerns, but I agree that the rates of conversion in California and Washington far exceed rates of conversion in Oregon, and a lot of that has to do with our land use laws. But I wouldn't want us to get too comfortable with that. I think there are real risks for a lot of areas in seeing conversion begin to pick up speed because of the loss of value to a working forest land and the pressure to provide more housing and just meet other values. So we need to be careful about that.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think it's just the land use laws. It's the Land Use and an Efficient and Effective Forest Practice Act. I mean, California takes you a year more to get a harvest on the ground and an incredibly high cost. We have a system in place in Oregon where people can be responsive to markets. They don't have to get a permit. They just notify us. We have a high degree of compliance with the Forest Practice Act. We're measuring that now regularly. Great compliance with reforestation. So I think you're absolutely right. You start adding regulatory burden to already, particularly where we have a challenging situation, and there'll be increasing pressure on the land use laws as we make more forest land marginal. So I think it's not just the land use laws, but coupled with that is an efficient and effective and not an overreach on our forest practices.
I agree with that. And then just to bring it back home to Eastern Oregon, it ties back to what happens to our federal lands. The federal lands with 70% of our forests have been key to maintaining the workforce and the mills and markets that exist. And if that doesn't change, we're going to see more loss, and that's going to have an effect irregardless of what happens to the Forest Practices Act.
So, Ann, you want to move to Andrew's presentation?
Okay.
You're going to get an expert up here to... Or I'll erase it.
I thought she'd get over there.
Not intentionally.
Right. Didn't have a pointer.
I didn't. I wasn't that interested.
Okay. We want to appreciate the work done by the Forest Carbon Task Force and Angus having the courage to take it on and integrating the U.S. Forest Service's Forest Inventory and Analysis data. We call them FIA. We will be building on the preliminary data set provided by the task force by working closely with the new Office of Carbon Policy and FIA program. FIA is uniquely qualified to perform this analysis because they perform a comprehensive survey of forest vegetation on 5,180 forested field plots in Oregon every 10 years. The current sampling design was installed in 2000, and FIA is in the seventh year of their first remeasurement. The remeasurement of plots provides the information to calculate growth, removals, and mortality of trees. So this partnership will produce three analyses and reports for the Board of Forestry and the Office of Carbon Policy. The first report will be the storage and flux of carbon in Oregon's forest ecosystem. The second report will come in two phases. The first phase will be the flow of carbon through harvested wood products, and the second phase will be sawmill energy production and consumption in Oregon. It's not working. Can you advance to the next one?
I'll just do it.
It's not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can, but it's bad.
It could be that. Oh, God, it's not fancy. Here, there's something here.
Did you use all the power?
Magic fingers, huh? You know, anytime I get near a piece of machinery.
Oh, I'm all right, thanks.
There we go. Okay, thank you. Okay, so the organization of the Forest Ecosystems Report will be organized pretty much similar to the California report that was produced for the California Board of Forestry. FIA will produce documentation, tables, and summaries for the pools of carbon in forest ecosystems using existing algorithms and refining estimates using regional biomass equations to include rate of carbon flux through components such as coarse roots, foliage, and snags. Tables and summaries will be extended to each major ecoregion and ownership with emphasis on maintaining landowner confidentiality. The report will be prepared for the Board of Forestry and Office of Carbon Policy. We hope that the tables will be ready by December 2018 and a draft report by January 2019. And we recognize that there's going to be a need to repeat the analysis and report on a regular basis, say every 5 years. Sounds reasonable. California is repeating their analysis every single year. And the next report and analysis will be focused on carbon in Oregon's harvested wood products. The harvested wood products analysis will be based on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's production and accounting approach, which has been adopted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to accurately account for carbon flux associated with wood products. FIA will be working with researchers from the Business and Bureau of Economic Research at University of Montana to identify and collect Oregon timber harvest data across all ownerships for 2017 to the most historic vintage year possible. I think California was 1909, and we'll find out what that is for Oregon when they get started on this. They will develop or refine timber product classes and ratios required by the web-based accounting tool that they use. And I want to point out the graphic in the center of the slide was a graphic of the model that is used by the researchers to estimate carbon flow through harvested wood products. And this model was developed by Kenneth Skog, who was on the Nobel-winning prize team that Al Gore is part of, so it has international recognition. And the researchers will conduct research to understand the history of Oregon's forest product industry to develop primary product ratios tailored to changes in Oregon's production through time. And the carbon accounting tool will be used to conduct uncertainty simulations specific to Oregon's harvested wood products. And we are planning to have a workshop with the researchers to discuss harvested wood products carbon accounting methods with stakeholders. And the second phase of the harvested wood products report will focus on sawmill energy consumption and production in Oregon. This research will integrate a survey of Oregon timber processors to collect energy consumption and production at each sawmill facility. Analysis will include the percent consumption of each energy source, such as electricity, each type of fossil fuel, and the amount of wood and bark that is used. This analysis will develop high-resolution profiles of energy use and emissions to identify opportunities for energy efficiency gains, expansion of industrial bioenergy, and potential fossil fuel displacement in the sawmill industry. This information is fundamental for any policies that get made so that we can evaluate the trade costs and benefits and the trade-offs. Okay, so this final report, I think Peter started talking about it, is a need for analysis that involves simulations to understand long-term carbon consequences among alternative forest carbon mitigation strategies. The first reports I talked about were historic looking. And this report and this analysis is forward looking. It looks into the future about the trade-offs, given the information and the knowledge that we have. And we hope these simulations could integrate costs and benefits of increased sequestration in forests, new technologies and end-of-life utilization for wood products, wood product strategies and effects of substituting more carbon-intensive products, effects of predicted changes in climate, and the downstream economic consequences. I know some of those are a big reach, but we would like to be able to discuss them as going forward with this research. And we're looking for an open, transparent process that integrates a systematic review that integrates the knowledge that we have from researchers across the spectrum in forest carbon so that we can get a sensitivity analysis of the parameters that are involved in this research. And I want to point out that these areas do not have scientific consensus and are likely to remain contentious. And finally, we have convened a stakeholder advisory group to provide feedback, guidance, and critical review. And this advisory group is supported in partnership between ODF and the Office of Carbon Policy. It is composed of conservation organizations, representatives from forest landowners, and the forest products industry. And we're looking for an open and transparent process through the production of all of these reports. And that's my presentation.
Any questions about this process? Anything else?
So I will add a little bit. So the board put this on their emerging issue, and I did not imagine this being the outcome of the emerging issue. But
it's emerged.
Yeah. Andrew, particularly because of the efforts by the legislature to further carbon policy and the establishment of Oregon's Office of Carbon Policy. I agree with Andrew that there is not scientific consensus, and there are actually camps of different types of scientists with quite opposing points of view about what the right strategy is, which makes it really challenging. And I'll even characterize the camps. We have the sort of the ecologically based scientists, and they have a view that's more oriented towards storing carbon in ecological systems. We have the forest management scientist camp, and they have more interest in storing carbon in wood products and utilizing the forest. And then we have people like me, which would be the bureaucratic scientists, who haven't figured out our interests yet, but we certainly have them. And so we're entering an area where when you don't have scientific consensus, I think the only thing we can do for the board and the Office of Carbon Policy is be as open and transparent as possible. Each of these studies are tiered with increasing difficulty. There's probably strong consensus on the forest ecosystem pools and what are the right assumptions and equations for that. There is uncertainty around that. When you get into the harvested wood products pool, less agreement about what the rate should be, which is why we're bringing in a third-party group to look at that. The one that will be really most contentious is the last one, which will be the simulation of carbon mitigation strategies. And we'll see how that goes. But I think having it come to the department and going in front of the board and then to the Global Warming Commission is kind of the appropriate approach.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We have several folks who have signed up to appear on this issue. First two are Megan Tuttle and Cassie Phillips.
Good morning.
Hi.
Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and board members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Megan Tuttle, and I am the Western Environmental Affairs Manager at Weyerhaeuser Company. Weyerhaeuser owns 1.6 million acres in Oregon, where we have operated for over 100 years and have 1,000 employees. Weyerhaeuser forests are certified to third-party sustainable forestry standards, and our manufacturing facilities produce more than 70% of their own energy with renewable biomass. We appreciate the efforts of State Forester Doherty and the department in focusing on carbon sequestration and for developing a carbon stakeholder advisory committee. Full disclosure, I'm actually a member of that advisory committee. We support ODF's initial efforts to develop a storage and flux assessment of Oregon carbon using FIA data and a harvested wood product study using the standard forest service model. Our forests and the wood products developed in Oregon are an important part of the climate solution. Wood-based products are renewable, store carbon, and avoid GHG emissions if used to replace more energy-intensive materials. Though the carbon sequestration benefits of trees have always been known, more leading climate thinkers are realizing that greater use of biogenic renewable materials will be an important global greenhouse gas mitigation strategy. According to the most recent FAO report on forests and wood products, increased use of wood offers important mitigation potential when it displaces fossil fuel-intense products. Production of wood-based materials and products results in lower greenhouse gas emissions than productions of other materials such as concrete, metal, bricks, and plastic. FAO calculated that the use of wood-based building materials avoids emissions of 483 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent annually via substitution effects. As we continue to discuss Oregon's role in carbon sequestration, it is key that we recognize the carbon neutrality of Oregon forests. Oregon is the largest producer of lumber in the U.S., which is the global leader in lumber production, and we play a globally significant role. Our native species, Douglas fir, has incredible qualities for construction material, and Oregon's soils are some of the most productive in the nation. Policy decisions related to forest carbon benefits must stay within the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the current studies are the right start to emphasize our forest carbon neutrality. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Cassie Phillips, and I am a retired Weyerhaeuser employee. I'm here strictly on my own. Megan, coincidence, you put us together. Megan doesn't know what I'm going to say, and she may be nervous about that.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah. I was a member of the Forest, the Global Warming Commission's Forest Carbon Accounting Task Force, and I'm in the awkward position that as a member of the task force, the task force produced no report. And we had really no opportunity to comment on the written products produced by the commission. So we're in an awkward position where my name is on the task force report, but I, in fact, have never commented on it. There are many things in it that I agree with, but there are some things I disagree with. I finally concluded the best thing to do was to just write my comments in the form of a public comment to the commission, and I intend to do that. But I thought there's a chance to come and give you my point of view today, so I thought I'd take advantage of it. There are basically three points I'll make. One is, or maybe four, one is the process one, is that there is no task force report. What Angus presented is there's a task force review and I would say general agreement up to about the first four slides maybe, and then everything else is the point of view of the commission or commissioners. I also would comment that commission recommendations by statute require public comment before being submitted, and so I don't know the commission's process well enough to know if they put the work that Angus is presenting out for public comment, but that's a process step that I would imagine that they'll want to do before the results are viewed as official, but I leave that up to the commission. The results show, and we're all very happy to see, that Oregon's forests are a net sink and that they're a net sink across all land ownership classes in all regions, which I will say was a little bit of a pleasant surprise. The concerns, so those are all good things that I was happy to support and see. The concerns, major concerns I have is that there's a lot of suggestions in the presentations about there being losses on forest lands. The private forests, and my perspective is one from, really it's a private land perspective. I started my career many years ago as a forester for the Washington DNR, but it would be really foolish of me to present, suggest I know anything about Oregon state lands. But from a private landowner perspective, to present the reductions from harvest as if they are a loss means that you're assuming a no harvest baseline. To say there's a loss of carbon from harvesting, you're saying that's an assumption that the base what we're comparing you to is no harvest. And I think private forest landowners especially would find that very objectionable. You know, they harvest 2% of their land a year if you're a 50-year rotation, and that 2% pays for everything that you have to do on the other 98%. It's not you don't separate the two. A private landowner doesn't view their lands as harvest lands and everything else. They view it all as one ownership, and they have to balance the income from the 2% that pays for all the costs on the others. It concerns me a lot to see it presented that way. The other reason it's a concern is if you do think about getting into compensation systems or carbon credits or offset credits, if you've assumed a no harvest baseline, then there's never any opportunity for credit. So you've given away any opportunity you had to create a forest carbon credit system in Oregon. The other final point is that missing completely from the task force work was any kind of economic analysis. We never ever had any economic information presented to us. And so the kinds of trade-offs that you're talking about, the impacts on, I mean, just the cost effects and the impacts on communities, the kind of mill closures you would see and the economic devastation you would see if you did stop timber harvesting on private lands was not discussed from a policy standpoint, but it also wasn't discussed from an analytical standpoint. And so I was glad to hear that you're talking about that third phase of a study where you would look at and try to model those long-term and big picture trade-offs. That's not an easy thing to do, but I will say I did see a study work as an economist at the university or at Ohio State named Brent Songren. And Brent has developed a big, I'm sorry, I am completely not an economist, but it's a big, an input-output model that models, that use the real data from the national forest land base and crank through the cost, you know, the trade-offs and cost. What happens if you impose a harvest tax? What happens if you impose a harvest tax but also offset it with a with a sequestration credit, or you do nothing. And what they concluded, and I have his graduate student's doctoral dissertation, I don't know if it's been published, but what they concluded is that the worst thing you can do is impose a harvest tax and nothing else, that you will end up with less carbon after that than if you did nothing. Or I think if you have a no harvest alternative. No, it couldn't be true. But the optimal solution is to have a combination of a tax and a subsidy, but you have huge distributional effects on that. People treat it differently, and you end up having to have sort of massive federal land use controls that I think are politically probably impractical. They do reference another study that has a more politically palatable solution that would be worth looking at. But that's the kind of modeling that you would have to do to really understand the trade-offs, and the task force did not do any kind of economic analysis. I could talk all day about things like wood product sequestration and encourage the use of the tremendous work that's been done by the Forest Service, EPA, and others as very active parts of the UN FCC. But I could see from Andrew's presentation that you're going to be doing that, so I'll leave you alone and leave it at that. But thanks a lot for the chance to come and talk to you today.
Thank you both for coming. Next two are Heath Curtis and Keith Williams.
Chair Emerson, State Forester Doherty, members of the board. For the record, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. You heard Mr. Duncan tell you that Oregon's forests are sequestering over half of Oregon's anthropogenic emissions every year, and that much is true. Landowners of every stripe in Oregon are growing more trees per year than are lost to harvest or mortality. Private industrial lands, as was mentioned earlier, aren't contributing to global atmospheric carbon dioxide emissions. To the contrary, by the Global Warming Commission's own numbers, they're actively removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere every year. This is well settled. We see similar results in other jurisdictions in the Western United States. Unfortunately, Mr. Duncan's presentation then transitions to talking points we've heard from the GEOS Institute, from the Center for Sustainable Economy. He implies in that last graphic that we could regulate Oregon forest landowners in a manner that causes them to harvest even fewer trees. This would be done in the name of decreasing the total emissions attributable to Oregon. Hydrocarbon emissions by other sectors would be offset by growing trees in Oregon, and if you constrain the accounting in that manner, it looks like Oregon's total emissions are reduced in similar proportion. That's the yellow curve down and the green curve up. We believe that approach is fundamentally flawed. Decreasing the number of trees harvested in Oregon does not, in fact, decrease the number of trees used for construction or wood products here or elsewhere. That means that while we could reduce the number of trees coming off of Oregon's forest lands, we do nothing to actually sequester more carbon globally. The only thing Mr. Duncan's approach accomplishes is further choking the Oregon timber industry and the rural communities it supports in a symbolic gesture that would make no difference in terms of global carbon dioxide concentrations. That can't be the right answer. Oregon trees are a renewable resource that literally absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in order to create wood products we all use every day. No other building product can make a similar claim. Relative to alternatives, wood is almost always the best answer. We firmly believe, along with most scientists who've considered the question, that the best strategy for actually reducing global carbon dioxide emissions, not just those attributable to Oregon, is to use more Oregon wood, not less.
Board members, my name is Keith Williams. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Simpson Lumber Company. Simpson's based in Portland and been in Oregon for many years. We've been in business for 160 years, and we've been in a single business, and that is growing trees and harvesting trees, sawmilling, producing primarily studs. I've brought an example of our product today, and in this example product, my 10th grade biology teacher taught me that this is made of carbon and water. And I'd like to think about that, or ask you gentlemen to consider that It's a pretty simple concept. This is carbon and water. We're in a building today that I'm surmising is probably greater than 50 years old. And as we look around in the building, we see examples of this very thing. This is probably 1 month from harvest. The forest products in this building are, I would surmise, at least 50 years from harvest. And my biology teacher told me they're made of carbon. And they're still carbon today. That hasn't changed. They have lost moisture content. It's dropped over the years. But the carbon is still intact in this older building. Similarly to the carbon in this 2x4, it still has quite a bit of moisture content. So as the department considers wood product storage, I would encourage the department to consider storage, especially in solid wood products, which is Oregon is known for, as some of our prior guests have spoken, and that product storage lasts for a long time. And upon a prior employment role that I had, I was an active trader in the carbon schemes in California. I was also a carbon project developer across forest throughout the United States. The forest product carbon storage is very important for private landowners to be able to participate in that scheme. So I would urge the department to consider such as they move forward developing policy and recommendations. Finally, I'd like to take issue with the fire comments made earlier by Mr. Duncan. Having traded in the California schemes, having developed projects, I understand that when trees are killed in a fire, the dead standing still counts as carbon. However, they are no longer sequestering carbon. Furthermore, when that dead standing drops through loss below a height of 15 feet, that carbon is no longer accounted for. It is assumed it is released in the atmosphere. So I ask that you consider that within a 20-year period following fire resulting in forest mortality, that carbon is released into the atmosphere through accounting measures that the California Air Resources Board has in place and the traders trade on. Those projects are measured against. This is likely to wind up in the frame of a home that will last much longer than 20 years. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you both. We'll now take a break until 10:45.